Chapter 9. The Funeral. 1. From 9 o'clock on, out-of-towners who had known or worked with Ruth McCausland began to come into Haven Village. Soon, almost every parking space along Main Street was taken. The Haven Lunch did a brisk business. Beach kept busy, short-ordering eggs, bacon, sausages, and home fries. He brewed pot after pot of coffee. Representative Brennan hadn't come, but he had sent a close aide. "Should have come yourself, Joe," Beach thought, with a little sunken smile. "Might have got a whole slew of new ideas about how to run the government." The day dawned brisk and clear, more like late September than late July. The sky was bright blue, the temperature a moderate 68 degrees, the wind out of the west at about 20 miles an hour. Once more, there were outsiders in Haven, and once more, Haven had gotten lucky weather for them. And soon it wouldn't matter whether they were lucky or not, the townsfolk told each other without speaking. Soon they would be in charge of their own luck. A good day, you would have said. The best kind of New England summer's day, the sort the tourists come for. A day to prick the appetite fully alive. Those who came to Haven from out of town ordered hearty breakfasts, as people with lively appetites are apt to do, but Beach noted that most of those breakfasts came back only half-eaten. The newcomers lost their appetites quickly. The light went out of their eyes, and they began to look, for the most part, shallow and a little sick. The lunch was crowded, but conversation lagged. "Must be the air here in our little town don't quite agree with you folks," Beach thought. He imagined going into the storeroom, where the device he had used to get rid of the two nosy cops was hidden under a pile of tablecloths. He imagined bringing it out here, a great big deadly bazooka, and just washing his lunchroom clean of all these outsiders with a purifying blast of green fire. "No, not now. Not yet. Soon it wouldn't matter. Next month. But for now..." He looked down at the plate he was scraping and saw a tooth in someone's scrambled eggs. "Tommyknocker's coming, my friends," Beach thought. "Only when they finally get here, I don't think they'll even bother knocking. I think they'll just blow the fucking door right down." Beach's grin widened. He scraped the tooth off the plate with the rest of the garbage. 2. Dugan could be silent when he wanted, and this morning that was what he wanted. Apparently, it was what the old man wanted, too. Dugan had gotten to Ev Hillman's apartment building on Lower Main promptly at 8, and had found a Jeep Cherokee standing at the curb behind the old party's Valiant. There was a big gunny sack in the back, its top tied with hay rope. "Did you rent this in Bangor?"
"Leased it at Derry, AMC," Ev said.
"Must have been expensive."
"'Twasn't too dear."
That ended the conversation. They arrived somewhere near the Albion Haven town line an hour and 40 minutes later. "We'll be doing a bit of back roading," the old man had said, and if that wasn't a classic understatement, Butch didn't know what was. He had been driving in this part of Maine for almost 20 years, and before today had thought he knew it like the back of his hand. Now he knew better. Hillman knew it like the back of his hand. By comparison, Butch Dugan had a general working knowledge of the area, no more. They went from the turnpike to Route 69, from 69 to two-lane blacktop, then to gravel in western Troy, then to hardpan, then to rutted dirt with grass growing up the middle, finally to an overgrown logging track that looked as if it might have last been seriously used around 1950.
"Do you know where the fuck you're going?"
Butch shouted as the Cherokee crashed through rotted corduroy, then hauled itself out, engine howling, all four wheels spinning up mud and chewed splinters. Ev only nodded. He clung to the Cherokee's big wheel like an old balding monkey. One woods road led into another, and finally they crashed out of a scree of foliage and onto a dirt road Butch recognized as Albion Town Road Number 5. Butch had thought it impossible, but the old man had done exactly what he promised, brought them all the way around Haven without ever once going in. Now Ev brought the Cherokee to a stop just 100 feet short of the marker announcing the Haven Town line. He turned off the engine and unrolled his window. There was no sound but the tick of the engine. There was no bird song, and Butch thought this odd.
"What's in that gunny sack back there?" Butch asked.
"All kinds of things. No need to worry about it now."
"What are you waiting for?"
"Church bells," Ev said.
3. It was not the Methodist church bells that Ev had grown up with and expected, which rang out at 9:45, calling Ruth's mourners, both the real ones and those prepared to shed copious floods of crocodile tears, to the Methodist church, where the first act of the 3-act festivities was to be played out. Act 2, graveside ceremonies. Act 3, refreshments in the town library. Reverend Gooringer, a shy man who usually had not the fortitude to say boo to a goose, had gone around town a few weeks ago telling people he was getting damn tired of all that gonging.
"Then why don't you do something about it, Gooey?"
Pamela Sargent asked him. Reverend Lester Gooringer had never been called Gooey in his entire life, but in his current state of rancor he barely noticed it.
"Maybe I will," he said, looking at her through his thick glasses grimly. "Just maybe I will."
"Got any ideas?"
"I might," he said slyly. "Time'll tell, won't it?"
"It always does, Gooey," she said. "Always does."
The Reverend Gooringer, in fact, had a fine idea about those bells. He could hardly believe it had never occurred to him before. It was so simple and beautiful. And the best thing about it was that he wouldn't have to take it up with the deacons, or with the Ladies' Aid, an organization which apparently attracted only 2 types of women, fat slobs with boobs the size of barrels, and skinny-assed, flat-chested sluts like Pamela Sargent with her fake ivory cigarette holder and her raspy smoker's cough, or with the few well-to-do members of his congregation. Going to them always gave him a week's worth of acid indigestion. He did not like to beg. No, this was something the Reverend Lester Gooringer could do all by himself. And so he did it. Fuck 'em if they couldn't take a joke.
"And if you ever call me Gooey again, Pam,"
he had whispered as he rewired the fuse box in the church basement so it could handle the heavy voltage his idea would require,
"I'll jam the plumber's friend in the parsonage pissoir up your twat and plunge out your brains if you haven't pissed 'em all away."
He cackled and went on rewiring. Reverend Lester Gooringer had never had such blunt thoughts or said such blunt things in his life, and he found the experience liberating and exhilarating. He was, in fact, prepared to tell anyone in Haven who didn't like his new carillon that they could take a flying fuck at a rolling donut. But everyone in town had thought the change nothing short of magnificent. It was, too. And today the Reverend Gooringer felt a real heart swell of pride as he flicked the new switch in the vestry and the sound of the bells floated out over Haven, playing a medley of hymns. The carillon was programmable, and today Lester Gooringer plugged in the hymns which had been particular favorites of Ruth's. They included such old Methodist and Baptist standbys as "What a Friend We Have in Jesus" and "This Is My Father's World." The Reverend Gooringer stood back, rubbing his hands together, and watched as people began to move toward the church in groups and 2s and 3s, drawn by the bells, the calling of the bells.
"Hot damn!" the Reverend Gooringer exclaimed.
He had never felt better in his life, and he meant to send Ruth McCausland off in style. He intended to preach one pie-cutter of a eulogy. After all, they had all loved her.
4.
The bells. Dave Rutledge, Haven's oldest citizen, tipped an ear toward them and smiled toothlessly. Even if the bells had jangled discordantly, he would have smiled because he could hear them. Until early July, Dave had been almost completely deaf, and his lower limbs were always cold as his circulation steadily failed. He was, after all, 90, and that made him an old dog. But this month, his hearing and circulation had magically improved. People told him he looked 10 years younger, and by Christ he felt 20 years younger. And my, wasn't the sound of those bells playing just the sweetest thing. Dave got up and started toward the church. 5. The Calling of the Bells. In January, the aide U.S. Representative Brennan had sent to Haven had been in D.C., and there he had met a beautiful young woman named Annabel. This summer she had come to Maine to be with him, and had come to Haven with him this morning to keep him company. He had promised her they would overnight in Bar Harbor before going back to Augusta. At first she thought it had been a bad idea, because she began to feel a little nauseated in the restaurant, and hadn't been able to finish her breakfast. For one thing, the short-order cook looked like an older, fatter version of Charles Manson. He kept smiling the strangest little smile when he thought no one was looking. It was enough to make you wonder if he had powdered the scrambled eggs with arsenic. But the sound of the bells chiming hymns she hadn't heard since her Nebraska childhood charmed her with wonder. My God, Marty, how can a little wide place in the road town like this afford a gorgeous Carolyn like that? Maybe some rich summer tourist died and left it to them, Marty said vaguely. He had no interest in the Carillon. He'd had a headache ever since they got here, and was getting worse. Also, one of his gums was bleeding. Pyorrhea ran in his family. He hoped to God it wasn't that. Come on, let's go over to the church, so we can get it done and go up to Bar Harbor and screw our brains out, he thought. This is one creepy little town. They started across the street together, she in a black suit, but, she told him archly on their way up, her underwear was all white silk. What little of it there was. He in a governmental charcoal gray. The people of Haven, dressed in their soberest finery, walked with them. Marty saw a surprising number of powder blue state police uniforms. Look, Marty, the clock. She was pointing at the tower of the town hall. It was good, solid red brick, but for a moment it seemed to swim and waver before Marty's eyes. His headache was instantly worse. Maybe it was eye strain. He'd had a checkup 3 months ago, and the guy had said his vision was good enough to fly a jet, but maybe he'd been wrong. Half the professional people in America were on coke these days. He had read all about it in Time. And why was his mind wandering like this anyway? It was the bells. They seemed to be echoing and multiplying in his head. 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, all playing, When We Meet at Jesus' Feet. What about the clock? He asked irritably. The hands are funny, she said. They look almost drawn on. 6. The Calling of the Bells. Eddie Stampnell of the Dairy Barracks crossed the street with Andy Rideout from Orono. Both of them had known Ruth, liked her. Pretty, ain't it? Eddie asked dubiously. Maybe, Andy said. I just keep thinking of Bent and Jingles getting blown away by a couple of numbnut rubes out here. Probably buried in some farmer's potato field, and it just sounds like a bone phone to me. Seems like Haven's bad luck now. I know, that's stupid, but that's how I feel. It's bad luck for my head, Eddie replied. It aches like a bastard. Well, let's get it over and get out, Andy said. She was a good woman, but she's gone. And between you and me, I don't care if I never spend another 15 minutes in Haven now that she is. They stepped into the Methodist church together, neither of them looking at Reverend Lester Gooringer, who stood beside the switch which controlled his lovely Carillon, smiling and rubbing his dry hands together and accepting the compliments of all and sundry. 7. The Crying of the Bells. Bobby Anderson got out of her blue Chevrolet truck, slamming the door, smoothing her dark blue dress over her hips, and checking her makeup in the truck's outside mirror, before walking slowly down the sidewalk to the church. She walked with her head down and her shoulders slumped. She was trying hard to get the rest she needed to go on, and Guard had helped to put a brake on her obsession. And that's what it is, an obsession. No use kidding yourself. But Guard was a brake that was slowly wearing out. He wasn't at the funeral because he was sleeping off a monumental drunk, his grizzled, worn face pillowed on one arm, his breath a sour cloud around him. Anderson was tired all right, but it was more than just that. A great, unfocused grief seemed to fill her this morning. It was partly for Ruth, partly for David Brown, partly for the whole town. Yet mostly, she suspected, it was for herself. The becoming continued, for everyone in Haven except Guard, that was. And it was good. But she mourned her own unique identity, which was now fading like a morning mist. She knew now that The Buffalo Soldiers was her last book, and the irony was that she now suspected the Tommyknockers had written most of that as well. 8. The bells, bells, bells. Haven answered them. It was Act One of a charade titled The Burial of Ruth McCausland, or How We Loved That Woman. Nancy Voss had closed the post office to come. The government would not have approved, but what the government didn't know wouldn't hurt them. They would know plenty soon enough, she thought. They would get a big old express mail delivery from Haven very soon. Them and every other government on this flying mudball. Frank Spruce, Haven's biggest dairy farmer, answered the bells. John Mumphrey, whose father had run against Ruth for the position of town constable, answered them. Ashley Ruval, who had passed her out by the town line 2 days before her death, answered them with his parents. Ashley was crying. Doc Warwick was there, and Judd Tarkington. Adley McKean came with Hazel McCready on his arm. Newt Berenger and Dick Allison answered them, walking slowly and supporting Ruth's predecessor, John Harley, between them. John was feeble and nearly transparent. Maggie, his wife, was not well enough to attend. They came, answering the summons of the bells. Tremaines and Thurlows, Applegates and Goldmans, Duplisseys and Archenborgs. Good Maine people, you would have said, drawn from a healthy stockpot that was mostly French, Irish, Scots, and Canadian. But they were different now. As they drew together at the church, so did their minds draw together and become one mind, watching the outsiders, listening for the slightest wrong note in their thoughts. They came together, they listened, and the bells rang in their strange blood. 9. Ev Hillman sat up behind the wheel of the Cherokee, eyes opening wide at the dim sound of the carillon. What in the hell? Church bells, what else? Butch Dugan said. Sounds very pretty. They're getting ready to start the funeral, I suppose. They're burying Ruth over in the village. What in God's name am I doing out here by the town line with this crazy old man? He wasn't sure, but it was too late to change his course now. The bells of the Methodist Church never made a sound like that before in my time, Ev said. Someone's changed them over. So what? So nothing. So everything. I don't know. Come on, Trooper Dugan. He turned the key and the Cherokee's engine roared. I'll ask you again, Dugan said with what he thought was extraordinary patience. What are we looking for? I don't rightly know. The Cherokee passed the town line marker. They had left Albion now and entered Haven. Ev had a sudden sickening premonition that in spite of all his precautions and care, he was never going to leave it again. We'll know it when we see it. Dugan didn't reply, only held on for dear life and wondered again how he had gotten into this. He had to be as crazy as the old fart he was riding with, and then some. He raised one hand to his forehead and began rubbing, just above the eyebrows. A headache was forming there. 10. There were sniffles, red eyes, and some sobbing as Reverend Gooringer, his bald head gleaming mellowly and in a soft variety of colors, courtesy of the summer sunshine, falling through the stained-glass windows, launched into his funeral eulogy following a hymn, a prayer, another hymn, a reading of Ruth's favorite scripture, the Beatitudes, and yet another hymn. Below him, foaming around the lectern in a semicircle, were great bunches of summer flowers. Even with the upper windows of the church thrown open and a good breeze blowing through, their smell was suffocatingly sweet.
We have come here to praise Ruth McCausland and to celebrate her passing, Gooringer began.
The townsfolk sat with hands either folded or gripping handkerchiefs. Their eyes, most wet, regarded Gueringer with sober, studious attention. They looked healthy, these folk. Their color was good, their skin for the most part unblemished. And even someone who had never been in Haven before could have seen that the congregation here fell naturally into two groups. The outsiders didn't look healthy. They were pale. Their eyes were dazed. Twice during the eulogy, people left hurriedly, dashed around the corner of the church, and were quietly sick. For others, the nausea was a lower complaint, an uneasy rolling in the bowels, not quite serious enough to cause an exit, but simply going on and on. Several outsiders would lose teeth before that day was over. Several developed headaches which would dissolve almost as soon as they left town. The aspirin finally working, they would surmise. And more than a few of them had the most amazing ideas as they sat on the hard pews and listened to Gueringer preach Ruth McCausland's eulogy. In some cases, these ideas came so suddenly and seemed so huge, so fundamental, that the persons to whom they occurred would feel as if they had been shot in the head. Such persons had to fight down an urge to bolt out of their pews and run into the streets screaming Eureka at full volume. The people of Haven saw this happening and were amused. All of a sudden, the apathetic pudding-like expression on someone's face would be shocked away. The eyes would widen, the mouth flop open, and the Havenites would recognize the expression of a person in the throes of a grand idea. Eddie Stempnell, of the Derry Barracks, for instance, conceived of a nationwide police band on which every cop in the land could communicate, and he saw how a cloak could easily be thrown over such a band. All those nosy civilians with their police band radios would be shit out of luck, would be shit out of luck. Ramifications and modifications poured into his mind faster than he could deal with them. If ideas had been water, he would have drowned. I'm going to be famous for this, he thought feverishly. Reverend Gueringer was forgotten. Andy Rideout, his partner, was forgotten. His dislike of this goofy little town was forgotten. Ruth was forgotten. The idea had swallowed his mind. I'm going to be famous, and I'm going to revolutionize police work in America. Maybe in the whole world. Holy shit. Holy shit! The Havenites, who knew Eddie's great idea would be foggy by noon and gone by three, smiled and listened and waited. Waited for it to be over, so they could get back to their real business. So they could get back to becoming. 11. They rolled down a dirt track, Town Road Number 5 in Albion, which became Fire Road Number 16 here in Haven. Twice, logging roads branched off into the woods, and each time one of these came up, Dugan braced himself for an even more bone-wrenching ride. But Hillman didn't take either. He reached Route 9 and swung right. He cranked the Cherokee up to 50 and headed deeper into Haven. Dugan was skittery. He didn't know exactly why. The old man was crazy, of course. The idea that Haven had turned into a nest of snakes was pure paranoia. All the same, Monster felt a steady, pulsing nervousness growing inside him. It was vague, a low grass fire in his nerves. You keep rubbing your forehead, Hillman said. I've got a headache. It'd ache a lot worse if the wind wasn't blowing, I guess. Another lapse into utter nonsense. What in God's name was he doing here, and why did he feel so goddamn jumpy? I feel like somebody slipped me a couple of sleeping pills. Hiya, Dugan looked at him. But you don't feel that way, do you? You're as cool as a goddamn cucumber. I'm scared, but I don't have the jitters, and I don't have a headache, neither. Why would you have a headache? Dugan asked crossly. The conversation had gotten decidedly Alice in Wonderland-ish. Headaches aren't catching. If you and six other guys are painting a closed room, you are all apt to end up with headaches. Ain't that a true fact? Yeah, I guess so, but this isn't... No, it ain't. And we got lucky with the weather. Just the same, I guess that thing is putting out a powerful stink, because you feel it. I can see you do. Hillman paused and then said another Alice in Wonderland thing.
Had any good ideas yet, Trooper?
What do you mean? Hillman nodded, satisfied.
Good. If you do, tell me. I got something in that sack for you.
This is crazy, Dugan said. His voice wasn't quite steady. I mean, utterly nuts. Turn this thing around, Hillman. I want to go back.
Ev suddenly focused a single phrase in his mind, as sharply and as clearly as he could. He knew from his last 3 days in Haven that Bryant, Marie, Hilly, and David were routinely reading each other's minds. He could sense it even though he couldn't pick it up. By the same token, he had come to realize they couldn't get into his head unless he let them. He had begun to wonder if it had something to do with the steel in his skull, a souvenir of that German grenade. He had seen the potato masher with dreadful, ineluctable clarity, a gray-black thing spinning in the snow. He thought, well, I'm dead, that's it for me. After, he remembered nothing until he'd awakened in a French hospital. He remembered how his head had hurt. He remembered the nurse who had kissed him, and how her breath had smelt like anise, and how she kept saying, shaping her words as if speaking to a very small child, Je t'aime, mon amour. La guerre est finie. Je t'aime. Je t'aime, les États-Unis. La guerre est finie, he thought now. La guerre est finie.
What is it? He asked Dugan sharply. What do you m—
Ev swerved the Cherokee over the side of the road, kicking up a spume of dust. They were a mile and a half over the town line now. It was another 3 or 4 miles to the old Garrick farm.
Don't think, don't talk, just tell me what I was thinking.
Tout fini. You're thinking, la guerre est finie.
But you're crazy. People can't read minds. They can—
Dugan stopped. He turned his head slowly and stared at Ev. Ev could hear the tendons in the man's neck creak. His eyes were huge.
La guerre est finie, he whispered. That's what you were thinking.
And that she smelled like licorice.
Anise,
Ev said and smiled. Her thighs had been white, her cunt so tight.
And I saw a grenade in the snow. Oh, Jesus, what's going on?
Ev pictured a red, old-fashioned tractor in his mind.
What now?
Tractor, Dugan husked. Farm ore. But you got the wrong tires on it.
My dad had a farm ore. Those are Dixie Field Boss tires. They wouldn't fit a fa—
Dugan suddenly turned around, grappled for the Cherokee's door handle, leaned out, and threw up.
12.
Ruth once asked me if I would read the Beatitudes at her funeral, if it should fall to me to preside over it.
The Reverend Gooringer was saying in a mellow Methodist voice the Reverend Donald Hartley would have completely approved of.
And I have honored her wishes. Yet,
la guerre. You were thinking, la guerre est—
Gooringer paused, a little expression of surprise and concern touching his face. A close observer might have thought a little gas had bubbled up, and he had paused to stifle an unseemly burp.
I think there is another set of verses she merits. They—
Tractor. Farm all tractor.
There was another small hitch in Gooringer's delivery, and that frown touched his face again.
Not the sort of verses, I suppose, that any Christian woman would dare ask for, knowing that a Christian woman must earn them. Listen as I read from the book of Proverbs, and see if you, who knew her, do not agree that this is the case with Ruth McCausland.
Those are Dixie Field Boss tires.
Dick Allison glanced to his left and caught Newt's eye across the aisle. Newt looked dismayed. John Harley's mouth had dropped open. His faded blue eyes shifted back and forth in bewilderment. Gooringer found his place, lost it, almost dropped his Bible. Suddenly he was flustered, no longer the master of ceremonies, but a divinity student with stage fright. As it happened, no one noticed. The outsiders were occupied either with physical distress or with mind-boggling ideas. The people of Haven drew together as an alarm went off, jumping from one mind to the next until their heads rang with it. This was a new carillon, one that jangled with discord. "Someone's looking where they have no business." Bobby Tremaine took Stephanie Coulson's hand and squeezed it. She squeezed back, looking at him with wide brown eyes, the alarmed eyes of a doe who hears the slide and click of the bolt in a hunter's gun. "Out on Route 9, too close to the ship. One's a cop. Cop, yes, but a special cop. Ruth's cop, he loved." Ruth would have known these rising voices. And now, even some of the outsiders began to feel them, although they were relatively new to Haven's infection. A few of them looked around like people coming out of thin dozes. One of these was the lady friend of Representative Brennan's aide. She had been miles from here, it seemed. She was a minor bureaucrat in Washington, but she had just conceived of a filing system that might well get her a fat promotion. Then, a random thought, a thought she would have sworn was not her own. "Somebody's got to stop them, quick," slashed across her mind, and she looked around to see if someone had actually called out aloud in the church. But it was quiet, except for the preacher, who had found his place again. She looked at Marty, but Marty was sitting in a glassy daze, looking at one of the stained glass windows with the fixed gaze of one deeply hypnotized. She supposed this to be boredom, and went back to her own thoughts. "Who can find a virtuous woman?" Goo-Ringer read, his voice a trifle uneven. He hesitated in the wrong places and stumbled a few times. "For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, and he shall have no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool." Now another burst of those alien thoughts came to the single sensitized ear in the church. "Sorry about that, I just couldn't—" "What?" "Holy Christ, that's Wheeling. How?" "There are two voices speaking, but we are only hearing one," the mind net thought, and eyes began to focus on Bobby. There was only one person in Haven who could make his mind opaque to them, and that person wasn't here now. "Two voices. Is the one we don't hear the voice of your drunken friend?" Bobby got up suddenly and worked her way along the pew, horribly aware that people were looking at her. Goo-Ringer, the ass, had paused again. "Excuse me," Bobby muttered. "Excuse me, excuse me." At last she escaped into the vestibule and the street. Others, Bobby Tremaine, Newt, Dick, and Bryant Brown among them, began to follow. None of the outsiders noticed. They had lapsed back into their strange dreams. 13.
"Sorry about that," Butch Dugan said.
He pulled the door closed, got a handkerchief out of his back pocket, and began to rub his mouth.
"I couldn't seem to help it. I feel better now."
Ev nodded. "I ain't going to explain. There isn't time. But I want you to listen to something."
"What?"
Ev snapped on the Cherokee's radio and dialed across the band. Dugan started. He had never heard so many stations, not even at night when they jumped all over each other, wavering in and out in a sea of voices. Nothing wavering about these. Most were bell clear. Ev stopped at a C&W station. A song by the Judds was just ending. When it did, there was a station ID. Butch Dugan could hardly believe what he was hearing. "WWVA," a perky girl group sang to an accompaniment of fiddles and banjos.
"Holy Christ, that's Wheeling," Dugan cried. "How?"
Ev snapped off the radio. "Now I want you to listen to my head." Dugan stared at him for a moment, utterly flummoxed. Not even Alice in Wonderland had been this mad.
"What in the name of God are you talking about? Don't argue with me. Just do it."
Ev turned his face away from Dugan, presenting him with the back of his head.
"I got two pieces of steel plate in my head. War souvenir. Bigger one's back there. See the place where the hair don't grow?"
Yes, but time is short. Put your ear up close to that scar and listen.
He did, and felt unreality wash over him. The back of the old man's head was playing music. It was tinny and distant, but perfectly identifiable. It was Frank Sinatra singing New York, New York. Butch Dugan began to giggle. Soon he was laughing. Then he was roaring, arms wrapped around his stomach. He was out here in the back of the beyond with an old man whose head had just turned into a music box. By God, this was better than Ripley's Believe It or Not. Butch laughed and gasped and wept and roared and... The old man's calloused palm slammed across his face. The shock of being slapped like a small child surprised Butch out of his hysteria as much as the pain had done. He blinked at Ev, one hand going to his cheek.
It started a week and a half before I left town, Ev said grimly. Blasts of music in my head. They were stronger when I got out this way, and I should have thought about that before now, but I didn't. They're stronger now. Everything is. So I got no time for you to get the scream in your hearts. Are you going to be all right?
The flush spreading over Dugan's face mostly hid the red mark Ev's hand had made. The screaming yaw-haws. That pretty well described it. First he had puked, and then he had had a fit of hysterics like a teenage girl. This old man wasn't just showing him up, he was pulling past him in second gear.
I'll be fine, he said. You believe now there's something going on here? That something in Haven has changed?
Yes, he swallowed. Yes, he repeated.
Good.
Ev stepped on the gas and roared back onto the road.
This thing, it's changing everyone in town, Trooper Dugan. Everyone but me. I get music in my head, but that's all. I don't read minds, and I don't get ideas.
What do you mean, ideas? What kind of ideas?
All kinds.
The Cherokee speedometer touched 60, then began to edge past it.
Thing is, I have no proof of what's going on, none at all. You thought I was right off in my head, didn't you?
Dugan nodded. He was holding on tight to the dashboard in front of him. He felt sick to his stomach again. The sun was too bright, dazzling on the windshield and the chrome.
The reporter and the nurses did, too. But there's something in the woods, and I'm going to find it, and I'm going to take some pictures of it, and I'm going to take you out, and we're going to do some loud talking, and maybe we'll find a way to get my grandson David back, and maybe we won't. But either way, we ought to be able to shut down whatever's going on here before it's too late. Ought to. We got to.
Now the speedometer needle hung just below 70.
How far?
Dugan managed through closed teeth. He was going to puke again, and soon. He just hoped he could hold on until they got to wherever they were going.
The old Garrick farm, Ev said. Less than a mile.
Thank God, Dugan thought. 14. It's not guard, Bobby said. Guards passed out on the porch of the house.
How do you know?
Adley McKean asked. You can't read 'em.
I can, though, Bobby said.
A little more every day. He's still on the porch, I tell you. He's dreaming about skiing. They looked at Bobby silently for a moment. About a dozen men standing across the street from the Methodist church in front of the Haven lunch.
Who is it, then?
Joe Summerfield asked at last.
I don't know, Bobby said.
Only that it's not guard. Bobby was swaying mildly on her feet. Her face was that of a woman who was 50, not 37. There were brown circles of exhaustion under her eyes. The men seemed not to notice. From the church, voices were raised in Holy, Holy, We Adore Thee.
I know who it is, Dick Allison said suddenly.
His eyes had gone strange and dull with hate.
Only one other person it could be. Only one other person I know of in town with metal in his head.
Ev Hillman, Newt cried.
Christ!
We've got to get moving, Judd Tarkington said. The bastards are getting close. Adley, get some guns from the hardware store.
Okay.
Get 'em, but don't use 'em, Bobby said.
Her eyes swept the men.
Not on Hillman, if it's him, and not on the cop, particularly not on the cop. We can't afford another mess in Haven. Not before...
the becoming. It's all finished.
I'll get my tube, Beach said. His face was vacant with eagerness.
Bobby grabbed his shoulder. No, you won't, she said. No more messes includes no more cops disappearing.
She looked at them all again, then at Dick Allison, who nodded.
Hillman's got to disappear, he said. No way around it. But that's maybe all right. Ev's crazy. Crazy old man might decide to do just about anything. A crazy old man might just decide to haul stakes and drive off to Zion, Utah, or Grand Forks, Idaho, to wait for the end of the world. The cop's going to make a mess, but he's going to make it in Derry, and it's going to be a mess everyone understands. No one else is going to shit in our nest. Go on, Judd, get the guns. Bobby, you pull in back of the lunch with your pickup truck. Newt, Adley, Joe, you ride with me. You go with Bobby, Judd. Rest of you, go in Kyle's caddy. Come on, hoss your freight. They got moving.
15.
Shh.
Same old dream. A few new wrinkles. Damn strange ones. The snow had gone pink. It was soaked with blood. Was it coming from him? Holy hell. Who'd have believed how much blood the old tosspot had in him? They're skiing the intermediate slope. He knows that he should have stayed on the beginner's slopes for at least one more session. This is too fast for him. And furthermore, all this bloody snow is very distracting, particularly when it's all your blood. Now he looks up, sending a rip of pain through his head, and his eyes widen. There's a jeep on the goddamn slope. Anne-Marie screams, "Stem, Bobby! Guard! Stem, Bobby!" But he doesn't need to stem Bobby, because this is just a dream. It's become an old friend in the last few weeks, like the erratic bursts of music in his head. This is a dream, and that isn't a jeep, and this isn't the straight arrow slope. It's turning into Bobby's driveway. Is this a dream? Or is it real? No, he realized, that was the wrong question. A better question would have been, how much of this is real? The chrome winked blinding arrows of light into Gardner's eyes. He winced and groped for, ski poles? No, not a dream. It's summer. You're in Haven. The porch railing. He could remember almost everything. It was hazy, but he could remember. No blackouts since he had come back to Bobby's. Music in his head, but no blackouts. Bobby had gone to a funeral. Later on, she'd come back and they would start digging again. He remembered it all, just as he remembered the town hall clock tower lifting off into the afternoon sky like a big-ass bird. All present and accounted for, sir. Except this. He stood with his hands on the railing, bleary, bloodshot eyes, watching the jeep in spite of the glare. He was aware that he must look like a refugee from the Bowery. Thank God there's still some truth in advertising. That's what I feel like. Then the man in the passenger seat turned his head and saw a guard. The man was so huge that he looked like a creature from a fairy tale. He was wearing sunglasses, so Gardner couldn't tell for sure if their eyes actually met or not. He thought they did. It felt that way. Either way, it didn't matter. He knew the look. As a veteran of 50 picket lines, he knew it well. He also knew it as a drunk who had awakened in the tank on more than one occasion. The Dallas police have arrived at last, he thought. The thought carried feelings of anger and regret, but what he felt mostly was relief. At least, for the moment. He's a cop. But what's he doing in a jeep? God, the size of his face. He's as big as a fucking house. Must be a dream. Must be. The jeep didn't stop. It rolled up the driveway and out of sight. Now Gardner could hear only its roaring motor. Headed out back, going up there in the woods. They knew all right. Oh, Christ, if the government gets it. All of his earlier dismay rose in him like bile. His dazed relief blew away like smoke. He saw Ted the Power Man throwing his jacket over the littered remains of the levitation machine and saying, "What gadget?"
Dismay was replaced by the old sick fury. "Hey, Bobby, get your ass out here," he shrieked in his mind as loudly and clearly as he could. Fresh blood burst from his nose and he staggered weakly back, grimacing in disgust and groping for his handkerchief. "What does it matter, anyway? Let them have it. It's the devil on either hand, and you know it. So what if the Dallas police get it? It's turning Bobby and everyone in town into the Dallas police, particularly her company. The one she brings out late at night when she thinks I'm asleep, the one she takes into the shed." This had happened twice, both times around 3 in the morning. Bobby thought Gardner was sleeping heavily, a combination of hard work, too much booze, and Valium. The level of pills in the Valium bottle was going steadily down, that was true, but not because Gardner was swallowing them. Each night's pill was actually going down the toilet. Why this stealth? He didn't know, any more than he knew why he had lied to Bobby about what he had seen on Sunday afternoon. Flushing a Valium tablet every night wasn't really lying, because Bobby hadn't asked him outright if he was taking them. She had simply looked at the decreasing level of the tablets and drawn an erroneous conclusion Gardner hadn't bothered to correct. Just as he had not bothered to correct her idea that he was sleeping heavily. In fact, he had been plagued by insomnia. No amount of drink seemed to put him under for long. The result was a kind of constant muddled consciousness, across which thin gray veils of sleep were sometimes drawn like unwashed stockings. The first time he had seen light splash across the wall of the guest room in the early hours of the morning, he had looked out to see a large Cadillac pulling into the driveway. He had looked at his watch and thought, "Must be the Mafia. Who else would show up at a farm way out in the woods in a caddy at 3 in the morning? But when the porch light went on, he had seen the vanity plate, Kyle 1, and doubted if even the Mafia went for vanity plates. Bobby had joined the 4 men and 1 woman who had gotten out. Bobby was dressed, but barefoot. Gardner knew 2 of the men, Dick Allison, head of the local volunteer fire department, and Kyle Archenborg, a local realtor who drove a fat-ass Cadillac. The 2 others were vaguely familiar. The woman was Hazel McCready. After a few moments, Bobby had led them to her back shed, the one with the big Krieg lock on the door. Gardner thought, "Maybe I ought to go out there, see what's going on." Instead, he'd lain down again. He didn't want to go near the shed. He was afraid of it, of what might be in there. He had dozed off again. The next morning, there had been no caddy, no sign of Bobby's company. Bobby had, in fact, seemed more cheerful, more her old self on that morning, than at any time since Gardner had returned. He had convinced himself it was a dream, or perhaps something, not the DTs exactly, but close, that had crawled out of a bottle. Then, not 4 nights ago, Kyle 1 had arrived again. Those same people had gotten out, met with Bobby, and gone around to the shed. Guard collapsed into Bobby's rocking chair and felt for the bottle of scotch he had brought out here this morning. The bottle was there. Gardner raised it slowly, drank, and felt liquid fire hit his belly and spread. The sound of the Jeep was fading now, like something in a dream. Perhaps that was all it had been. Everything seemed that way now. What was that line in the Paul Simon song? "Yes, sir. Michigan. Weird ships buried in the ground. Jeep Cherokees and Cadillacs in the middle of the night. Drink enough, and it all faded into a dream. Except it's no dream. They're the take-charge people, those people who come in the Cadillac with the Kyle 1 plates, just like the Dallas police, just like good old Ted with his reactors. What kind of shot are you giving them, Bobby? How are you souping them up even more than the rest of the resident geniuses? The old Bobby wouldn't have pulled that kind of shit, but the new, improved Bobby does. And what's the answer to all of this? Is there one?" "Devils on every side," Gardner cried out grandly. He slugged back the last of the scotch and threw the bottle over the porch railing and into the bushes. "Devils on every side," he repeated, and passed out. 16.
That guy saw us, Butch said as the jeep bulled across Anderson's garden in a diagonal, knocking over huge cornstalks and sunflowers that towered high over the Cherokee's roof.
I don't care,
Ev said, wrestling the wheel. They emerged from the garden on the far side. The Cherokee's wheels rolled over a number of pumpkins that were coming to full growth amazingly early. Their hides were strangely pale, and when they burst, they disclosed unpleasant, fleshy pink interiors.
If they don't know we're in town by now, then I'm wrong about everything. Look, didn't I tell you?
A wide, rutted track wound into the woods. Ev bounced onto it.
There was blood on his face, Dugan swallowed.
It was hard. His head ached very badly now, and all the fillings in his teeth seemed to be vibrating very fast. His guts were churning again.
And his shirt looked like somebody popped him one in the neck. Pull over. I'm going to be sick again.
Ev jammed on the brakes. Dugan opened the door and leaned out, vomited a thin yellow stream into the dirt, and then closed his eyes for a moment. The world was swooping and turning. Voices rustled in his head, a great many voices.
Guards saw them. He's yelling for help. How many?
Two in a Cherokee. They were headed.
Look, Butch heard himself say, as if from a great distance. I don't want to spoil the party, but I'm sick. Seriously sick.
Thought you might be, Hillman's voice came down a long, echoing hall.
Somehow Butch managed to haul himself up again in the passenger seat, but he didn't even have strength enough to pull the door closed. He felt as weak as a new kitten.
You ain't had time to build up any resistance, and we're right where it's strongest. Hold on. I got something that'll fix you up. At least I think I do.
Ev pushed the switch that lowered the Cherokee's electric rear window, got out, lowered the tailgate, and pulled out the gunny sack. He dragged it back to the jeep, and then hoisted it onto the seat. He glanced at Dugan and didn't like what he saw. The trooper's face was the color of candle wax. His eyes were shut, the lids purplish. His mouth was half open and he was breathing in quick, shallow gasps. Ev found a moment to wonder how whatever it was could be doing that to Dugan when he himself felt nothing, absolutely nothing.
Hang on, friend, he said, and used his pocket knife to cut the rope holding the neck of the bag.
Sick.
Dugan wheezed and retched brownish fluid. Ev saw that there were three teeth in the mess. He got out a light plastic oxygen supply tank, what the clerk at Maine Med Supplies had called a flat pack. He stripped the gold foil circle from the end of the hose leading out of the flat pack, revealing a stainless steel female connector. Now he brought out a gold-colored plastic cup, the sort jet airliners come equipped with. A segmented white plastic tube was attached to this, and at the end there was a white plastic male connector, a valve.
This don't work the way the guy said it would. I do believe this big fella's gonna die on me.
He slammed the male connector of the mask into the female connector on the oxygen supply, violent intercourse which he hoped would result in keeping Dugan going. He heard oxygen sighing gently inside the gold cup. All right, so far so good. He leaned over and put the cup over Dugan's mouth and nose, using the elastic straps. Then he waited anxiously to see what would happen. If Dugan didn't come out of his tailspin in 30 or 40 seconds, he would haul ass. David was missing and Hilly was sick, but neither thing gave him the right to murder Dugan, who hadn't known what sort of mess he was getting into. 20 seconds passed. Then 30. Ev dropped the Cherokee into reverse, meaning to turn around on the edge of Anderson's garden, when Dugan gasped, jerked, and opened his eyes. They looked very wide and blue and bewildered above the rim of the gold cup. Some color had come back into his cheeks.
What the hell?
His hands groped for the cup.
Leave it on,
Ev said, putting one of his big arthritis-warped old hands over one of Butch's.
It was the outside air poisoning you. You in a hurry for another dose?
Butch stopped reaching for the cup. It bobbed on his face as he said,
How long will this stuff last?
25 minutes or so, the guy said. It's a demand valve, though. Every now and then you can pull it down. When you start feeling woozy again, put it back on. I want to go on in, if you think you can.
It can't be far, and I feel like I got to know.
Butch Dugan nodded. The Cherokee lurched forward again. Dugan stared out at the woods around them. Silent. No birds, no animals. No nothing. This was very wrong. Very bad, and very damned wrong. Faintly, far back in his mind, he could hear thoughts like a whisper of shortwave transmissions. He looked at Ev.
What the blue fuck is going on here, anyway?
That's to find out. Without taking his eyes off the rough track, Ev rummaged in the sack. Dugan winced as the Cherokee's undercarriage screamed over a stump sawed off a little higher than the others. Ev brought out a big .45. It looked old enough for its original owner to have carried it in World War I.
Yours? Dugan asked.
It was amazing how fast the oxygen was bringing him around.
Yeah?
They teach you to use these things, don't they?
Yes,
although the one Hillman had looked like an antique.
You might have to use it today, Ev said and handed it over.
What? Have a care. It's loaded. Up ahead, the land suddenly sloped downward. Through the trees came a giant reflection, sunshine bouncing off a huge metal object. Ev stamped the brake, suddenly terrified to the depths of his heart.
What the hell?
He heard Dugan mutter beside him. Ev opened the door and got out. As his feet touched the ground, he became aware that the earth was crisscrossed with small, dusty cracks, and that it was vibrating very rapidly. At the next moment, music so loud it was deafening blew through his head at gale force. It went on for perhaps 30 seconds, but the pain was excruciating, and it seemed forever. At last, it simply winked out. He saw Dugan standing in front of the Cherokee, the cup now hooked under his chin. He held the flat pack by the strap in one hand, the .45 in the other. He was looking at Ev apprehensively.
I'm all right, Ev said.
Yeah? Your nose is bleeding. Just like that guy back at the farm we passed.
Ev wiped his nose with his finger and looked at the smear of blood. He wiped his finger on his pants and nodded toward Dugan.
Remember to put the mask back on when you start feeling woozy. Oh, don't worry.
Ev leaned back into the Cherokee and rummaged in his bag of tricks again. He brought out a Kodak disc camera and something that looked like a cross between a pistol and a blow dryer.
Your flare gun? Dugan asked, smiling a little.
Yeah?
Get on the gas again, trooper. You're losing your color.
Dugan pulled it up, and the two men started toward that glittering thing in the woods. 50 feet from the Cherokee, Ev stopped. It was more than huge. It was titanic. A thing that would perhaps be large enough to dwarf an ocean liner when completely uncovered.
Give me a hand, he said roughly to Dugan.
Dugan did as he asked, but wanted to know why.
Because I'm scared shitless, Ev said.
Dugan squeezed his hand. Ev's arthritis flared, but he squeezed back anyway. After a moment, the two men started forward again. 17. Bobby and Judd got the guns from the hardware store and put them in the back of the pickup. The side trip hadn't taken long, but Dick and the others had gotten a good start, and Bobby pushed the pickup as fast as she dared to catch up. The truck's shadow, shortening as the day approached noon, ran beside them. Bobby suddenly stiffened a little behind the wheel.
Did you hear it?
Heard something, Judd said. It was your friend, wasn't it?
Bobby nodded.
Guard saw them. He's yelling for help.
How many?
2. In a jeep. They were headed out to where the ship is.
Judd brought a fist down on one leg.
The fuckers! The dirty, snooping fuckers!
We'll catch them, Bobby said. Don't worry.
They were at the farm 15 minutes later. Bobby pulled her truck in behind Allison's Nova and Archenborg's Cadillac. She looked at the group of men and thought how much like the knights they had met out here this was. The ones who were to be made to become first, especially strong. But Hazel wasn't here, and Beach was. Joe Summerfield and Adley McKean had never been inside the shed either.
Get the guns, she told Judd. Joe, you help. Remember, no shooting unless you have to, and don't shoot the cop, no matter what. She looked toward the porch and saw Guard lying there on his back. Guard's mouth was open and he was breathing in slow, rusty snores. Bobby's eyes softened. There were plenty of people in Haven, Dick Allison and Newt Berenger, probably chief among them, who thought she should long since have gotten rid of Guard. Nothing had been said out loud, but in Haven you no longer had to say things out loud. Bobby knew if she put a bullet through Guard's head, there would be a whole platoon of willing workers out here an hour later to help bury him. They didn't like Guard, because the plate in his head made him immune to the becoming, and it made him hard to read. But he was her break, and even that was crap. The truth was simpler yet. She still loved him. She was still human enough for that. And they would all have to admit that, drunk or not, when they had needed a warning, Guard had given it. Judd and Joe Summerfield came back with the rifles. There were six of them, varied calibers. Bobby saw that five went to people she could trust completely. She gave the sixth, a .22, to Beach, who would complain if he didn't get a shooting iron. Occupied with the ritual of guns, none of them saw that Gardner had half opened his bloodshot eyes and was looking at them. No one heard his thoughts. He had learned how to seal them off. "Let's go," Bobby said, "and remember, I want that cop." They moved out in a group. 18. Ev and Butch stood well back from the edge of what was now a ragged slash, running better than 300 yards from right to left, and yawning 60 feet across at its widest point. Anderson's old mongrel of a truck stood off to one side, looking tired and used. Next to it was the souped-up payloader with its giant screwdriver snout. There were other tools in the lean-to of peeled logs. Ev saw a chain fall on one side, a chipper on the other. There was a big pile of sodden sawdust below the mouth of the chipper's exhaust vent. There were cans of gasoline in the lean-to and a black drum labeled diesel. When Ev had first heard those noises in the woods, he had thought New England paper must be doing some logging, but this was no logging operation. This was an excavation. That dish, that monstrous dish, glittering in the sun. The eye could not stay away. It was drawn back again and again. Gardner and Bobby had removed a lot more hillside. 90 feet of polished silver-gray metal now jutted out of the earth and into the green-gold sunlight. If they had looked into the slash, they would have seen another 40 feet or better. Neither of them went close enough to look. "Holy Jesus," Dugan said. The gold cup bobbed on his face, and above its rim his blue eyes bulged. "Holy Jesus, it's a spaceship. Is it ours, or is it Russian, do you think? Holy Jesus Christ, it's as big as the Queen Mary. That ain't Russian. That ain't. He fell silent again. In spite of the oxygen, his headache was coming back. Ev raised the disc camera and clicked off 7 shots as fast as his finger could push the camera's button. Then he moved 20 feet to the left and took another 5, standing by the chipper. "Move to the right," he said to Dugan. "Huh? You're right. I want you in these last 3, for perspective." "Forget it, Pop." Even muffled by the cup, there was a shrill note in Dugan's voice. "You don't have to. 4 steps will do it." Dugan moved 4 very small steps to the right. Ev raised the disc camera again, a Father's Day present from Bryant and Marie, and clicked off the final 3 shots. Dugan was a very big man, but the ship in the earth reduced him to the size of a pygmy. "Okay," Ev said. Dugan stepped quickly back to where he had been. He walked with mincing, tentative steps, looking at the great round object as he went. Ev wondered if the pictures would turn out. His hands had been shaking, and the ship, for it certainly was some sort of spaceship, might be putting out radiation that would fog the film. Even if it does come out, who's going to believe it? Who,
In a world where kids go off to the movies every damn Saturday and see things like Star Wars.
I want to get out of here, Dugan said. Ev looked at the ship a moment longer, wondering if David was in there, imprisoned, wandering through unknowable corridors, or passing through doorways cut for no human shape, starving in the darkness.
No. If he was in there, he would have starved a long time ago, starved or died of thirst.
Then he slipped the small camera in his pants pocket, walked back to Dugan, and picked up the flare gun.
Yeah, I guess.
He broke off, looking in the direction of the Cherokee. There was a line of men and one woman standing in the trees, some armed. Ev recognized all of them. 19. Bobby started down the slope toward the two men. The others followed.
Hello, Ev, Bobby said, pleasantly enough.
Dugan raised the .45, wishing bitterly for the familiar feel of his Service 357.
Stop, he said.
He didn't like the way the gold cup muffled the word, robbed it of authority. He pulled the air mask down.
All of you! Those of you with rifles, put them down. You're all under arrest.
You're outgunned, Butch, Newt Barringer said, pleasantly.
Damn tooting,
Beach growled. Dick Allison frowned at him.
You better put your mask on again, Butch, Adley McKean said with a lazy, mocking smile. I think you're losing it.
Butch had begun to feel woozy as soon as he pulled the mask off. Hearing the steady whisper of their thoughts made it worse. He pulled it up, wondering how much air could be left in the flat pack.
Put it down, Bobby said. And you put down the flare gun, Ev. No one wants to hurt you two.
Where's David? Ev asked roughly. I want him, you bitch.
He's on Altair 4, with Robbie the Robot and Dr. Mobius,
Kyle Archenborg said with a titter.
He's picnicking amid the Krell memory banks.
Shut up, Bobby said. She suddenly felt confused, ashamed of herself, unsure.
Bitch? Was that what the old man had called her? A bitch?
She found herself wanting to tell him that he was confused. She wasn't a bitch. That was her sister Anne. A sudden, confused image came to her. The old man's distress, guard's distress, even her own, all mingled. She was distracted. While she was, Ev Hillman raised the flare pistol and fired. If Dugan had done it, they would have read his intention before he could have acted, but the old man was different. There was a hollow thud and a whoosh. Beach Jernigan exploded into white flame and staggered backward, the .22 flying out of his hands. His eyes filmed, simmered, then burst as they filled with burning phosphorus. His cheeks began to run. He opened his mouth and began to claw at his chest as the superheated air he drew in expanded and ruptured his lungs. This all happened in a space of seconds. The line of men wavered and lost coherency as they stumbled backward, their faces blank with terror. They were hearing Beach Jernigan die inside their heads.
Come on!
Ev shrieked at Dugan and ran for the Cherokee. Judd Tarkington moved sluggishly to stop him. Ev swept the hot barrel of the flare gun across his face, branding his cheek and breaking his nose. Judd went flailing backward, stumbling over his own feet, went sprawling. Beach was burning on the muddy, churned ground. He clawed weakly at his throat, with one twisted, tallowy hand, shuddered, and then stilled. Dugan got moving, running after the old man, who was clawing at the driver's side door of the Cherokee. Bobby heard Beach's thoughts fade away, wink out, and turned to see that the old man and the cop were on the verge of getting away.
Jesus Christ, you guys, stop them!
That broke their paralysis, but Bobby moved first. She got to Ev and slammed the butt of the shotgun she was carrying into the nape of the old man's neck. Ev's face whacked the top of the Jeep's door. Blood sprayed from his nose and he dropped to his knees, dazed. Bobby raised the shotgun butt to hit him again when Dugan, standing on the other side of the Cherokee, fired the old man's .45 through the passenger window. Bobby felt a large, hot hammer suddenly slam her lower right shoulder. Her right arm was driven powerfully upward, and she lost her grip on the shotgun. The hammer numbed her flesh for a moment, and then the heat was back, an expanding furnace glow that was baking her from the inside out. She was thrown backward, her left hand going for the place the hammer had hit her, expecting to find blood, finding none, at least not yet, only a hole in her shirt and in the flesh beneath. The hole had hard edges that felt hot and throbby. Blood was running down her back, a lot of it. But shock had numbed her, and she felt little pain yet. Her left hand had found the small entrance wound. The exit wound was as big as a kid's fist. She saw Dick Allison, his face white and slack with panic. "This isn't going right. Christ, not right at all. Get him before he gets us, oh, you fucking snoop, fucking snoop, fucking snoop!"
"Don't shoot him!" Bobby screamed.
Pain exploded through her. Blood flew from her mouth in a scrawny spray. The bullet had torn her right lung open. Allison hesitated. Before Dugan could raise the gun again, Newt and Joe Summerfield had stepped in. Dugan turned toward them, and Newt clubbed the barrel of his rifle down on the hand holding the .45 as he did. Dugan's second shot went into the dirt.
"Hold it, trooper! Hold it or you're dead!"
John Enders, the grammar school principal, screamed.
"Four guns on you right now!"
Dugan looked around. He saw four men with rifles. And Allison, still wall-eyed and only one small step from unglued, looked ready to shoot the moment a squirrel farted. "They'll kill you anyway. Might as well go out like John Wayne. Shit, they're all crazy."
"No!"
Bobby said. She was leaning against the Jeep's hood now. Blood trickled steadily from her mouth. The back of her shirt was soaking.
"We're not crazy. We're not going to kill you. Check me."
Dugan probed clumsily toward Bobby Anderson's mind and saw that she meant it. But there was a catch somewhere, something he might have caught on to if he hadn't been so new at this eerie mind-reading trick. It was like the fine print in some slick car salesman's contract. He would think about it later. These guys were amateurs, and there might still be a chance to get away clean, if... Suddenly, Adley McKean ripped the gold mask off his face. Butch felt a wave of dizziness almost at once.
"I like you better this way," Adley said. "You won't think so much about escaping with your goddamn canned air turned off."
Butch fought the dizziness and looked back at Bobby Anderson.
"I think she's going to die."
"Think what you want." He straightened and took a step backward as that unexpected thought filled his head. He looked at her more closely.
"What about the old man?" he asked flatly.
"Not..." Bobby coughed, spraying more blood. Bubbles formed on her nostrils. Kyle and Newt started toward her. Bobby waved them back.
"Not your business. You and me are going to get in the front of the Jeep. You drive. There'll be three men with guns in the back, if you think of trying anything funny."
"I want to know what's going to happen to the old man," Butch repeated.
Bobby raised her gun with great effort. She brushed her sweaty hair away from her eyes with her left hand. Her right dangled uselessly by her side. It was as if she wanted Dugan to see her very clearly, to measure her. Butch did. The coldness he saw in her eyes was real.
"I don't want to kill you," she said softly. "You know that. But if you say one more word, I'll have these men execute you right here. We'll bury you next to beach and take our chances."
Ev Hillman was struggling to his feet. He looked dazed, not sure where he was. He armed blood off his forehead like sweat. Another wave of dizziness washed through Butch, and a thought of infinite comfort came to him.
"This is a dream. All just a dream."
Bobby smiled without humor.
"Think that if you want," she said. "Just get in the Jeep."
Butch got in and slid across behind the wheel. Bobby started around to the passenger side. She began coughing again, spraying blood, and her knees buckled. Two of the others had to help her.
"Never mind the think. I know she's going to die."
Bobby turned her head and looked at him. That clear, mental voice, "Think what you want," filled his head again. Archenborg, Summerfield, and McKean crammed into the back seat of the Cherokee.
"Drive,"
Bobby whispered.
"Slow."
Butch began to back up. He would see Everett Hillman once more, but would not remember. Later, most of Butch's mind would have been rubbed away like chalk from a blackboard. The old man stood there in the sunlight, that stupendous saucer shape behind him. He was surrounded by big men, and 5 feet to his left there was something on the ground that looked like a charred log.
"You didn't do too bad, old man. In your day you must have been quite a high rider. And you sure as hell weren't crazy."
Hillman looked up and shrugged, as if to say,
"Well, we tried."
More dizziness. Butch's sight wavered.
"I'm not sure I can drive," he said, his voice seeming to boom into his ears from a great distance. "That thing, it makes me sick." "Is there any air left in his little kit, Adley?"
Bobby whispered. Her face was ashy pale. The blood on her lips seemed very red by comparison.
"Face mask's hissing a little."
"Put it on him."
A moment after it was jammed firmly over Butch's mouth and nose again, he began to improve.
"Enjoy it while you can,"
Bobby whispered, and then passed out. 20.
"Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Thus we commit the body of our friend Ruth McCausland to the ground, and her soul to a loving God."
The mourners had moved on to the pretty little graveyard on the hill west of the village. They stood loosely gathered around an open grave. Ruth's casket was suspended over it on runners. There were far fewer mourners here than there had been in the church. Many of the out-of-towners, either headachy and nauseated or glowing feverishly with strange new ideas, had taken the chance afforded by the intermission between acts to slip away. The flowers at the head of the grave ruffled gently in a fresh summer breeze. As the Reverend Goo-Ringer raised his head, he saw a bright yellow rose go twirling down the grassy hill. Beyond and below Homeland's weather-beaten white fence, he could see the town hall clock tower. It wavered slightly in the bright air, like something seen through a heat haze. Still, Goo-Ringer thought it was a damned good illusion. These strangers in town had seen the best magic lantern slide in history, and didn't even know it. His eyes met Frank Spruce's for just an instant. He read relief clearly in Frank's eyes, and he supposed Frank could see it just as clearly in his own. Many of the outsiders would go back to wherever they came from and tell their friends that Ruth's death had rocked the little community to its foundations. They had hardly seemed to be there at all. What none of them knew, Goo-Ringer reflected, was that they had been following the events near the ship with most of their attention. For a while, things out there had gone very badly. Now they were under control again. But Bobby Anderson might die if they couldn't get her back to the shed in time, and that was bad. Still, things were under control. The becoming would continue. That was the only important consideration. Goo-Ringer held his Bible open in one hand. Its pages fluttered a little in the wind. Now he raised the other hand in the air. The mourners standing around Ruth's grave lowered their heads.
"May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord lift up his face and make it shine upon you, and give you peace. Amen."
The mourners raised their heads. Goo-Ringer smiled.
"There'll be refreshments in the library for those of you who'd care to stop by for a while and remember Ruth," he said.
Act 2 was over. 21. Kyle reached gently into Bobby's pants pocket and probed until he found her key ring. He worked it out, picked through the keys, and found the one that opened the padlock on the shed door. He inserted the key in the lock, but didn't turn it. Adley and Joe Summerfield were covering Dugan, who was still behind the wheel of the Jeep. Butch was finding it harder and harder to pull air from the mask. The needle on the supply dial had been in the red for 5 minutes now. Kyle rejoined them. "Go check the drunk," Kyle said to Joe Summerfield.
Looks like he's still passed out, but I don't trust the fucker.
Joe crossed the side yard, climbed the porch, and examined Gardner carefully, wincing at his sour breath. This time there really was no sham. Gardner had gotten a fresh bottle of scotch and had drunk himself into oblivion. As the two other men stood waiting for Joe to come back, Kyle said, "Bobby is most likely going to die. If she does, I'm going to get rid of that lush first thing." Joe came back.
"He's out."
Kyle nodded and turned the key in the shed's padlock as Joe joined Adley in keeping the cop covered. Kyle pulled the lock free and opened the door part way. Brilliant green light poured out. It was so bright it seemed to dim the sunlight. There was an odd liquid churning sound. It was almost, but not quite, the sound of machinery. Kyle took an involuntary step backward, his face tightening momentarily into an expression of fright, revulsion, and awe. The smell alone, thick and fetid and organic, was damn near enough to knock a man over. Kyle understood, they all did, that the two-hearted nature of the Tommyknockers was now growing together. The dance of deception was nearly done. Liquid churning sounds, that smell, and then another sound, something like the feeble, bubbly yap of a drowning dog. Kyle had been in the shed twice before, but remembered little about it. He knew, of course, that it was an important place, a fine place, and that it had speeded his own becoming. But the human part of him was still almost superstitiously afraid of it. He came back to Adley and Joe.
"We can't wait for the others. We've got to get Bobby in there right now, if there's going to be any chance of saving her at all."
The cop, he saw, had taken off the mask. It lay, used up, on the seat beside him. That was good. As Adley said out in the woods, he would think less about escaping without his canned air.
"Keep your gun on the cop," Kyle said. "Joe, help me with Bobby."
"Help you take her into the shed?"
"No, help me take her to the Rumford Zoo so she can see the fucking lion," Kyle shouted. "Of course, the shed."
I don't think I want to go in there. Not just now."
Joe looked from that green light back to Kyle, a shamed, slightly sickened smile on his lips.
"I'll help you," Adley said softly. "Bobby's a good old sport. Be a shame if she croaked before we got to the end of it."
"All right," Kyle said. "Cover the cop," he said to Joe. "And if you screw up, I swear to God, I'll kill you."
"I won't, Kyle," Joe said.
That shamed grin still hung on his mouth, but there was no mistaking the relief in his eyes.
"I sure won't. I'll watch him good."
"See that you do," Bobby said feebly.
It startled them all. Kyle looked at her, then back at Joe. Joe flinched away from the naked contempt in Kyle's eyes. But he didn't look toward the shed, toward that light, those churning, squelching sounds.
"Come on, Adley," Kyle said at last. "Let's get Bobby in there. Soonest started, soonest done."
Adley McKean, 50-ish, balding and stocky, flagged for only a moment. He licked his lips.
"Kyle, is it bad in there?"
"I don't really remember," Kyle said. "All I know is I felt wonderful when I came out. Like I knew more, could do more."
"Oh," Adley said in an almost non-existent voice. "You'll be one of us, Adley," Bobby said in that same feeble voice.
Adley's face, although still frightened, firmed up again.
"All right," he said.
"Let's try not to hurt her," Kyle said.
They got Bobby into the shed. Joe Summerfield turned his attention briefly away from Dugan to watch them disappear into that glow. And it seemed to him that they really did disappear rather than just step inside. It was like watching objects disappear into a dazzling corona. His lapse was brief, but it was all the old Butch Dugan would have needed. Even now he saw the opportunity, but he was simply unable to use it. No strength in his legs, churning nausea in his stomach,
His head thudded and pounded.
I don't want to go in there.
Nothing he could do about it if they decided to drag him in, though. He was as weak as a kitten. He drifted. After a while, he heard voices and raised his head. It took an effort, because it seemed as if someone had poured cement into one of his ears until his head was full of it. The rest of the posse was pushing out of the tangle that was Bobby Anderson's garden. They were shoving the old man roughly along. Hillman's feet tangled and he fell down. One of them, Tarkington, kicked him to his feet, and Butch got the run of Tarkington's thoughts clearly. He was outraged at what he thought of as the murder of Beach Jernigan. Hillman stumbled on toward the Cherokee. The shed door opened then. Kyle Archenborg and Adley McKean came out. McKean no longer looked frightened. His eyes were glowing, and a big toothless grin stretched his lips. But that wasn't all. Something else. Then Butch realized. In the few minutes the two men had been inside there, a large portion of Adley McKean's hair appeared to have disappeared. I'll go in any time, Kyle, he was saying. No problem. There was more, but now everything wanted to drift away again. Butch let it. The world dimmed out until there was nothing left but those churning sounds and the afterimage of green light on his eyelids. 22. Act 3. They sat in the town library. The name would be changed to the Ruth McCausland Memorial Library, all agreed. They drank coffee, iced tea, Coca-Cola, ginger ale. They drank nothing that was alcoholic. Not at Ruth's wake. They ate tiny triangular tuna fish sandwiches. They ate similar ones containing a paste of cream cheese and olives. They ate sandwiches containing a paste of cream cheese and pimento. They ate cold cuts and a jello salad with shreds of carrot suspended in it like fossils in amber. They talked a great deal, but the room was mostly silent. If it had been bugged, the listeners would have been disappointed. The tension that had drawn many faces tight in the church as the situation in the woods teetered on the dangerous verge of careening out of control had now smoothed out. Bobby was in the shed. That nosy Parker of an old man had also been taken in. Last of all, the nosy Parker policeman had been taken into the shed. The group mind lost track of these people as they went into the thick, corroded brass glow of that green light. They ate and drank and listened and talked, and no one said a word, and that was all right. The last of the outsiders had left town following Gueringer's graveside benediction, and they had haven to themselves again. Will it be all right now? Yes, they'll understand about Dugan. Are you sure? Yes, they will understand. They will think they understand. The tick of the Seth Thomas on the mantelpiece, donated by the grammar school after last year's spring bottle and can drive, was the loudest sound in the room. Occasionally there was the decorous clink of a china cup. Faintly beyond the open-screened windows, the sound of a faraway airplane. No birdsong. It was not missed. They ate and drank, and when Dugan was escorted from Bobby's shed around 1:30 that afternoon, they knew. People rose, and now talk, real talk, began all at once. Tupperware bowls were capped, uneaten sandwiches were popped into baggies. Claudette Ruval, Ashley's mother, put a piece of aluminum foil over the remains of the casserole she had brought. They all went outside and headed toward their homes, smiling and chatting. Act 3 was over. 23. Gardner came to around sundown with a hangover headache and a feeling that things had happened which he could not quite remember. Finally made it, Gard, he thought. Finally had yourself another blackout. Satisfied? He managed to get off the porch and to walk shakily around the corner of the house, out of view of the road, before throwing up. He saw blood in the vomit and wasn't surprised. This wasn't the first time, although there was more blood this time than ever before.
Dreams.
Christ, he'd had some weird nightmares, blackout or no. People out here, coming and going. So many people that all they needed was a brass band and the Dallas...
Police. The Dallas police were out here this morning, and you got drunk so you wouldn't see them, you fucking coward.
Cowgirls. Nightmares, that was all. He turned away from the puddle of puke between his feet. The world was wavering in and out of focus with every beat of his heart, and Gardner suddenly knew that he had edged very close to death. He was committing suicide after all, just doing it slowly. He put his arm against the side of the house and his forehead on his arm.
"Mr. Gardner, are you all right?"
"Huh?" he cried, jerking upright. His heart slammed two violent beats, stopped for what seemed forever, and then began to beat so rapidly he could barely distinguish the individual pulses. His headache suddenly cranked up to overload. He whirled. Bobby Tremaine stood there, looking surprised, even a little amused, but not really sorry for the scare he had given Gardner.
"Gee, I didn't mean to creep up on you, Mr. Gardner."
"You fucking well did, and I fucking well know it." The Tremaine kid blinked rapidly several times. He had caught some of that, Gardner saw. He found he didn't give a shit. "Where's Bobby?" he asked. I know who you are. I know where you are, right in front of me. Where's Bobby?"
"Well, I'll tell you," Bobby Tremaine said.
His face became very open, very wide-eyed, very honest, and Gardner was suddenly forcibly reminded of his teaching days. This was how students who had spent a long winter weekend skiing, screwing, and drinking looked when they started to explain that they couldn't turn in their research papers today because their mothers had died on Saturday.
"Sure. Tell me."
Gardner leaned against the clabbered side of the house, looking at the teenager in the reddish glow of sunset. Over his shoulder he could see the shed, padlocked, its windows boarded up.
The shed had been in the dream, he remembered.
Dream? Or whatever it is you don't want to admit was real. For a moment the kid looked genuinely disconcerted by Gardner's cynical expression.
Miss Anderson had sunstroke. Some of the men found her near the ship and took her to Derry Home Hospital. You were passed out.
Gardner straightened up quickly. Is she all right?
I don't know. They're still with her. No one has called here. Not since 3 o'clock or so, anyway. That's when I got out here.
Gardner pushed away from the building and started around the house, head down, working against the hangover. He had believed the kid was going to lie, and perhaps he had lied about the nature of what had happened to Bobby, but Gardner sensed a core of truth in what the kid said. Bobby was sick, hurt, something. It explained those dreamlike comings and goings, he remembered. He supposed Bobby had called them with her mind. Sure. Called them with her mind, neatest trick of the week. Only in Haven, ladies and germs.
Where are you going?
Tremaine asked, his voice suddenly very sharp. Derry. Gardner had reached the head of the driveway. Bobby's pickup was parked there. The Tremaine kid's big yellow Dodge Challenger was pulled in next to it. Gardner turned back toward the kid. The sunset had painted harsh red highlights and black shadows on the boy's face, making him look like an Indian. Gardner took a closer look and realized he wasn't going anywhere. This kid with the fast car and the football hero shoulders hadn't been put out here just to give Guard the bad news as soon as Guard managed to throw off enough of the booze to rejoin the living.
Am I supposed to believe Bobby was out there in the woods, excavating away like a madwoman, and she keeled over with a sunstroke while her sometime partner was lying back on the porch drunk as a coot? That it? Well, that's a good trick, because she was supposed to be at the McCausland woman's funeral. She went into the village, and I was out here alone, and I started thinking about what I saw Sunday. I started thinking, and then I started drinking, which is mostly the way it works with me.
Of course, Bobby could have gone to the funeral, come back here, changed, gone out in the woods to work, and then had a sunstroke. Except that isn't what happened. The kid's lying. It's written all over his face. And all of a sudden, I'm very fucking glad he can't read my thoughts.
I think Miss Anderson would rather have you stay here and keep on with the work, Bobby Tremaine said evenly.
You think?
That is, we all think.
The kid looked momentarily more disconcerted than ever, wary, a bit rocky on his feet. Didn't expect Bobby's pet drunk to have any teeth or claws left, I guess. That kicked off another much queerer thought, and he looked at the kid more closely in the light, which was now fading into orange and ashy pink. Football hero's shoulders, a handsome, cleft-chinned face that might have been drawn by Alex Gordon or Bernie Wrightson, deep chest, narrow waist. Bobby Tremaine, All-American. No wonder the Coulson girl was nuts over him. But that sunken, infirm-looking mouth went oddly with the rest, Gardner thought. They were the ones who kept losing teeth, not Gardner. Okay, what's he here for? To guard me, to make sure I stay put, no matter what. Well, all right, he said to Tremaine in a softer, more conciliatory voice, if that's what you all think. Tremaine relaxed a little. It really is. Well, let's go in and put on the coffee. I could use some. My head aches, and we'll have to get going early in the morning. He stopped and looked at Tremaine. You are going to help out, aren't you? That's part of it, isn't it? Yes, sir. Gardner nodded. He looked at the shed for a moment, and in the fading light he could see brilliant green tattooed in the small spaces between the boards. For a moment his dream shimmered almost within his grasp. Deadly shoemakers hammering away at unknown devices in that green glare. He had never seen the glow as bright as this before, and he noticed that when Tremaine glanced in that direction, his eyes skittered away uneasily. The lyric of an old song floated, not quite randomly, into Gardner's mind and then out again. Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Green door. What's that secret you're keeping? And there was a sound, faint, rhythmic, not at all identifiable, but somehow unpleasant. The two of them had faltered. Now Gardner moved on toward the house. Tremaine followed him gratefully. Good, Gardner said, as if the conversation had never lagged. I can use some help. Bobby figured we'd get down to some sort of hatchway in about 2 weeks, that we'd be able to get inside. Yes, I know, Tremaine said without hesitation. But that was with two of us working.
Oh, there'll always be someone else with you,
Tremaine said and smiled openly. A chill rippled up Gardner's back.
Oh?
Yes, you bet. Until Bobby comes back.
Until then.
Tremaine agreed. Except he doesn't think Bobby's going to be back, ever. Come on, he said. Coffee, then maybe some chow.
Sounds good to me.
They went inside, leaving the shed to churn and mutter to itself in the growing dark. As the sun disappeared, the stitching of green at the cracks grew brighter and brighter and brighter. A cricket hopped into the luminous pencil mark one of these cracks printed onto the ground and fell dead.